session number 25054, reel 11.
Derek Plummer, Reel 11. So, you went to Cochin in India.
Yes. Oh,
sorry, just before we start that, is a note you want to make on...
The captain who took over from Pinky Buchan, Charles Shelley Battersby, and his little saying about, you know, treat me gently, fish is smelly, I'm Percy Fisher. He finished the war, and after the war he was promoted to commander, which he deserved, and... one job he did was naval attaché Lisbon. And I don't know when this was, but I was abroad at the time. I heard it years after it had happened, so I don't know the details. He was naval attaché. There had been a fleet exercise, and four destroyers or frigates went into Lisbon as an official visit afterwards. There was a reception given by the Portuguese in that first evening. He, being the naval attaché, had worked out a program for the two or three days they're going to be there. He went down to see all the ships on arrival, and he said, look, I'm sorry, there's a bit of shortage of transport, so I'll bring my own personal car down, and I can take three of the first lieutenants. There were four there, I believe, in all, four ships, four first lieutenants. So he took three first lieutenants to this party. Going alongside at Lisbon is a wonderful event, but it's like going alongside Trafalgar Square, except Trafalgar hasn't got a river. Three sides of the square are in the town, into the centre of Lisbon. The fourth side is out onto the river, Tagus, isn't it, the river Tagus. And so you berth alongside that, and all this is parveyed up here, and people walk down there with prams and children and friends, and they sort of wave to you as a ship. It's a very, very... lovely setup. He came down at 6 o'clock or whatever time it was to collect the three first lieutenants. They all got in the car, and moments later they were over the side and all four drowned in the car. Someone told me this years later, and one of the first lieutenants I thought I knew, I think one of them was Lieutenant Paffard, who was my term, but I know nothing more than that, and the man who told me said, I expect Battersby had had a few drinks before he went, and I said, well, actually, I know him, I knew him, he didn't drink at all, and I didn't tell him about his infliction. I think what happened, possibly, he had one of these ghastly things, and right alongside, straight over, no hope at all. I only hope that on the way down, he said, treat me gently, fish is smelly, because... this was the end of him. It was a very, very extraordinary end for a man who'd spent his life saying that. Yeah. Really odd. So, yes. So that was it. That was the end of him. A very, very nice officer indeed. Yeah.
So off to Cochin, India.
Yes.
You hadn't been to India before.
No, I haven't.
So how did the... is Cochin's on the coast? Is it
on yes, it's on the coast. Yes.
How big an establishment does the Royal Navy have there?
They didn't have one. They'd turned it over to the Indians by now in partition. I was there as a guest from abroad and ran the new entry officers training school there. You weren't in Cochin. Cochin is, as you go into this narrow entrance to a huge area, and in the middle of that huge area there are a number of islands, and the biggest island is called Willingdon Island, after Lord Willingdon, and Cochin is sort of a quarter of a mile away, so to get from one there you need a boat. The establishment was on that island. The only thing on Willingdon Island was a very nice hotel called the Malabar, a huge naval establishment turned over to them by the RN, and an airfield where Air India flew their daily service in and out of Cochin, and a dockyard with deep water berth, which was close to the Malabar Hotel. The Navy really took well over half of the island. The rest, the hotel and the deep water berth and the airfield, and the rest of it was just wasteland, no hills or anything, just flat.
And who were you training?
Indians, yes. Taken, selected by headquarters, naval headquarters in Delhi and from university, and recruited, and they all turned up. And at the end of 12 months, we hope would produce something like a naval officer in them.
That, so this is all for British Navy?
No, all Indian, all Indian, only, yes.
So you're working
for the Indians, yes. And I went out with the team. My boss was the Lieutenant Commander Booker, Maurice Booker, who had been had a good war in destroyers and never stopped talking about it. And he'd also learned a bad habit, and that was drink. And after 3 months, he was up in Bangalore Hospital with DTs and finally sent home. I went up once to see him, and he asked me to pack all his gear up and send it home. He wasn't married. He'd been divorced about 100 times, I think. And he got home, and shortly after, I think he died. Maurice Booker, a nice man, but he just couldn't stop drinking. So the Commodore sent for me and said, who was an English Commodore, he said, did I want another boss, or would I take over? I said, I'll take over. And so I became the officer in charge of new entry officers training. And we worked out a plan. We commandeered classrooms and accommodation. I even got their own wardroom so that they didn't have to feel out of things with the main wardroom for all the senior, the other officers. A huge wardroom. It's an enormous establishment. We had our own little wardroom for the training officers and the officers under training, and own accommodation down there. Classrooms. I collected together over the time I was there 16 sailing boats from Bombay, brought down by warships when they came, Indian ships coming down. And when I was joined, there was no sailing boat at all. So I got dinghies and any sort of, it doesn't matter what, as long as they sail. And none of the officers we got ever could swim because they'd never even seen the sea, most of them. So I wouldn't let them go out sailing with me until they'd proved they could swim. So there was a wonderful incentive. It was a great, great time.
Because the India presumably hadn't had its own navy before.
Yes, it had. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes.
When it was a colony.
Oh, yes, Royal Indian Navy it was.
Right. So it was British.
Now it was Indian Navy. Yes. So ships which had been HMS were now INS, Indian Naval Ships.
Right. So this must have been a complete sort of reorganization and rejigging for the whole of the Indian fleet.
Oh, yes, complete, yes. But it went.
It was a time of enormous flux.
Yes, yes. And in Willingdon Island, on Willingdon Island, we had a gunnery school, a cookery school, a navigation school, a TAS school, torpedo, and so, and new entry officer school. There were schools everywhere. And it was a very busy time.
And this was after independence, was it?
Yes, yes.
What was the attitude of the Indians to you? I don't know
what they said behind their backs, but you couldn't get rid of them. They hung on your every word. It was very embarrassing. I didn't realize they would quote you verbatim. And after I first was there, we decided that we would use the 12 months by doing 6 months at Cochin in the new entry school, getting rid of most of the information. And after that, they would go to various other schools within the base and learn a bit more about gunnery and so on. And then at the end of the 12 months, they'd come back for a final month with us, and they're passing out exams and so on. And they then went to sea. And it was, but you couldn't say a thing that wasn't mentioned. They didn't query anything if they thought they understood. And I remember the first thing, we were talking about an operation you did on the forecastle with cables, and I said, if you do this, it works. If you do it the other way, you end up with a bunch of buggers, which was a naval expression for a great big mess on the forecastle. And of course, I thought it would go over their heads. And the exam paper, I asked them at the end, and the papers went to the Commodore. And he sent for me, and he said, what the hell have you been doing? And I said, why? He said, look at this. Everyone has got this quote of yours. About 30 officers have written this. If you don't do that, you end up with a bunch of So I gave up all these colloquialisms. I thought it was the wrong thing. But they were wanted. They hung on your every word. Weekends, they insisted on taking. I was then married. My wife, that one, died. But they would take us and one daughter I had with me out all day for picnics. We went up to Cochin, the Maharaja Cochin's palace, and we went up into the forest. We rode on elephants' backs. It was absolutely marvellous. They did all this for us.
Yeah. How long were you there for?
2 years, yeah. 2 and a bit.
Did you want to stay?
I think I would have stayed forever.
Yes.
I loved it, absolutely loved it.
Yeah. So after 2 years, you then went there.
I went to, I told you, in Lochocaig.
Right, okay. So tell me about that. So you came back from India.
Yes.
Did you get any choice of where you went next? Or
well, I... the appointment of officers was done by the Second Sea Lord's Office, and who was and it was always known as NA2SL, Naval Assistant to the Second Sea Lord. Sounds like a chemical formula, NA2SL. And you go to an NA2SL's office, and you meet the people who actually do the appointing. Very, very few people actually did that. They just waited for an appointment. But long, long before that, I'd learnt that if you go up personally, you can very often get what you ask for. They might say you're asking for something you can't get. But I remember I went up always to see what done. After India, I went to NA2SL's office. I forget who the appointer was, the actual, it was always a commander. And he said, well, what do you want to do now? And I said, well, I'd like to go back to sea. And he said, well, you've got a long history with anti-submarine warfare. He said, would you like to go to Derry? And I said, yes, and that's what happened. I've got a... Lochocaig was a Derry ship, really.
Could you spell Lochocaig?
L-O-C-H-A-R-K-A-I-G. Right. Don't ask me where it is. It's in Scotland.
It's in Scotland?
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay, right. It's in the centre of it. I've occasionally located it on a map.
Okay. So, arriving at Lochocaig, what did you find there?
I found... it was it wasn't nearly as exciting as a destroyer. It was this is a frigate, so it had no guns as such. It's all anti-submarine war, and no RNVR or RN officer. Everybody RN, and most of them fairly a small wardroom with four very keen lieutenants, all trying to make their mark for promotion. They're thinking of nothing else but their future all the time. They did well, all of them, in later life. But I don't know. It was interesting, but thank God I wasn't one of the people who wanted to stay at sea all my life. I was much more interested.
What exactly? It was anti-submarine work.
Yes.
What equipment did you have? What had changed since you were in destroyers?
Very little. But we were also. Teaching the long course of, if you want to specialise in anti-submarine warfare, I told you when you joined you could remain a salt horse like myself, or you could specialise. We had the specialist classes up there, and so a lot of the work was giving the ship to them and saying, okay, now you carry out the next attack. So, which was easy for us because we'd done it 100 times, but they were doing it for examination purposes, under observation, everybody criticising everything, that sort of thing. But and also learning new techniques and improving what we'd got.
During the war, had you been to the anti-submarine school in Liverpool, in Gladstone Dock?
No.
I asked you that, and you said you had.
Oh, but it wasn't called the anti-submarine. I can't remember. There was a special name for it. Everybody knew that there was a captain in charge, and everybody knew his name. And it was, yes, I did go up there. You sit in a huge room, and the floor is the ocean, and you have a desk, and you have a wren alongside you who's going to help you. And you sit there waiting, and a convoy leaves here, and you've got to get it there. And one of you is in charge, senior officer. All the rest are private ships. And everything is done by signals, which arrive on you. It's all worked out beforehand, and you get a signal put on your wrist, and you turn to the wren and say, what the hell do I do now? Or if you're clever, you do it yourself, and the wren criticizes you. And if you make a mistake, of course, very soon you find that you've got surrounded by 3 U-boats who are going to sink you. And it was great fun, very, very interesting, and slick. It worked like a clockwork. And at the end of the week, you really felt very, very competent.
They were actually teaching you then?
Oh, yes.
Like it was, as
you say.
So it improved your skills.
Yeah, it was great fun, too. Absolutely marvellous. And you go back to... we were billeted in a hotel. It was only a week's course. And afterwards, you could stand at the bar of the hotel, seeing which way you've gone wrong. I think, well, tomorrow I'll improve on that. But no, it was good. And it was a special man, Captain Willis. Everybody knew him. Everybody who had been there said, you know, it's the best course of the lot. It was wonderful. It's interesting, amusing, and very tense at times.
Because I think one of the leading wrens there, that's the right phrase, was Mary Poole, who was instrumental in organising it.
Yes.
Not a name you remember.
No, not... no.
Okay. Right, so back to Lockhart Cay. How long were you there?
I think a year and a half only.
Right, yeah. And you were ready to move then?
Yes.
Right, and where to then?
I left her in Tilbury. No, at... not Tilbury. I forget where it was. Chatham. We went to Chatham from Ireland.
Lockhart Cay. Went
to
Scotland.
Yeah, it was in yes. No, Lockhart Cay was in Ireland,
right.
In Londonderry,
okay.
With a Derry flotilla.
Yeah.
Then we went to be repaired down at
so
Chatham.
Which ship is this?
Lockhart Cay.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and we steamed down. We left Ireland.
Sorry, I thought it was a place, not a ship.
No.
I should have known. That's why I was asking silly questions.
And we turned up to de-ammunition at Chatham, and the first night we were there, it was a terrible accident. There was the dockyard. There's a dark lane road with high walls coming from the town, and a bus came down there, and there was a party at night time, and there was a party of Boy Scouts or something marching down the road, and it ran into the whole lot of them, killed them. It was terrible. But I left then and went up to, I was appointed to the staff officer at HMS Claverhouse in Edinburgh, and that was an RMVR establishment.
Right, so can you just tell me that name again?
Yes.
Staff officer at HMS?
Claverhouse, C-L-A-V-E-R, House.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So, what rank were you now?
Lieutenant Commander.
Lieutenant Commander. Mm-hmm.
When
were you made up?
Halfway through my time in Lockhart Cay.
Right. So this was for the RNVR.
RNVR, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was training. The RNVR was a very, very efficient force. And of course, when the war came out, we couldn't have done without them. Mm-hmm. Those that remain RNVR had to do 2 weeks training. Complete training, going to sea, 2 weeks each year, and they were required to appear at the training establishment once every week on Thursday nights. So there was an establishment which catered for everything, all branches, manned by the RN, and one chap in charge, the staff officers, myself, and we had one other officer. We had two minesweepers, and the staff officer had to organize during the summer months and spring months, trips in the minesweeper. Usually we went to Norway, sometimes to France and Holland. If I could get one of the RMVR officers to take command, they would take it away with a completely RMVR crew, no RN. Very often I went in command because I couldn't get anyone to take command of the particular minesweeper, but with an entire RMVR crew. Great fun, wonderful.
What was the difference between these were officers you were training, right?
Officers and ratings.
And
yes, yeah.
What was the difference between the RNVR people,
yeah,
and the naval people?
Well, it was so close to the war that most of them had a vast experience at sea in the war, and they were, all intents and purposes, the same as myself. They'd had the same experiences. They'd been at sea, many of them, much longer than I had.
Were there less public school boys in the
army? No, they were all public schools. Most of them were dukes and earls. Scotland's riddled with earls, isn't it? And, a lot of the officers were what we call lawyers, and they call writers to the signet, and a lot more were doctors. Edinburgh was stiff with. We had many real surgeons. Once you're in the Navy, a doctor's called a surgeon. So, but we had a mass of surgeons up there as well, so... if you got rid of the earls and they got rid of the writers to the signet and got rid of the doctors, there weren't very many seaman officers left.
Yeah.
But they were all, they were masters at fetters and schools like that. They were lawyers and doctors. Very interesting. All of them doing very well for themselves in Edinburgh. Lovely place.
What about the ratings?
Ratings were good. They were very keen indeed. But a lot of them, again, ex-war, they all had medals, they'd been to sea. So it wasn't difficult teaching them anything about the Navy. It was putting in time to make sure they'd done there once a week and done a fortnight at sea. Many of them wanted to go to sea more than a fortnight. If there were three or four visits to Norway organized, many of them would want to go each time.
Mm.
If their firm, whatever they were working for, would give them time off.
Mm. was there any other jobs in the Navy you'd rather have been doing? I mean, was there any practice? I mean, the Korean War must have been starting soon and so on. Did you want to be, in any action that was going?
No, I don't think so. I was happy as I was.
Right, okay. So how long were you at Claverhouse?
I think about a year and a half. And I, in desperation, it was during the Queen's coronation, and she came up to Edinburgh after the coronation, did her version of the coronation ceremony up in Edinburgh, and one or two of the officers I had were involved in that. They were the, it's a special uniform they wear. It's a green, arrows. Bowman or something, and this, yeah. Yes, and several of them were members. Yeah, and we, as I had served with Mountbatten, well, Philip Mountbatten, he was now Duke of Edinburgh. And
so,
he,
where did you serve with him?
Royal Arthur, Corsham.
Oh, right.
Yeah, he was one of the divisional officers there.
Okay.
So
what sort of a chap was he?
Well, he was irascible. He was a very bad tempered man when he was upset. He worked very hard indeed.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't bear publicity, and he kept... Hello!
So I was just asking you about Prince Philip. So he was wary of publicity. So
yes, I say that because at the time, as he was just Lieutenant Mountbatten, they left him alone, and he was very, very busy reading and putting his own comments along his uncle's, a book on the Burma campaign, which was an enormous task. He'd sit up at 2 a.m. working in his cabin there on this wretched book. But typical of his attitude towards the press, we had a bowls team. That is pub bowls, not out on grass. And I think we were called the Moonrakers. And we had our bowling alley was at the Methuen Arms in Corsham, and he was in the team. And so was I. And when it was announced that he was going to marry the Princess Elizabeth, of course, we were surrounded by publicity. And we went down in cars. We had a match down with a local team in the Methuen Arms that night. And we sort of surrounded by photographers and press people. And he swept them all aside and said, please, and sort of rushed into a back alley where the bowling alley was. And we shut the door. And we got, after a few drinks, we started the game. And every now and again, the door burst open. So I thought everything we'd ask them, and someone would come in. And finally, he lost his temper. And I don't know if you know how heavy a thing is. And he used words which I haven't heard since on my mother's knee. And screamed at this person. And he threw. He said, I'll give you 1 second to get out. And he threw this, and it was a huge door, wooden door in this old hotel, and it split the door when it landed. It would have killed the man.
Mm.
And this is his attitude. He would not tolerate it. I don't blame him, but I think he saw that he was going to suffer an awful lot of that in the coming months.
Mm. Did you ever see Princess Elizabeth?
Never. No. She sent a car for him. He had a little MG, which was given, a black MG, HRX 99, I think the number was. And that was, I think, given to him by the Queen Mother to begin with. But he was hit by an RAF vehicle at a place called Halavington, which is quite on his way down from the Buckhouse after a weekend up there. And it was damaged. He couldn't use it anymore. So that, for the next few months or weeks, on a Friday night, a plum-coloured Daimler turned up at the establishment, and chauffeur-driven, he disappeared up to London.
Right, okay.
I also played squash with him. There was a squash court, but it didn't belong to the Navy, it belonged to someone privately there.
Mm. Mm. So, HMS Claverhouse, and then where to after that?
Claverhouse to Sierra Leone.
Oh, right, yes. So, did you want to go abroad?
Yes, I did. I asked for that one particularly.
Mm-hmm. Why Sierra Leone?
I went, as I told you, to NAC, Naval Assistant Second Sea Lords Office, and I found the appointer, and he said, now what do you want? I said, anything abroad, hotter the better. So he said, well, there's a job in Sierra Leone. You can go there. And I said, what's it like? He said, I had no idea. And I remember it was one of those open offices, and he shouted and said, anyone here know just how bloody Freetown is? I thought, what an introduction. Someone said it's damned hot or very hot or even worse. And he said, thanks, there you are. And everybody shouted, it's the white man's grave, because that was a sort of common idea of West Africa. And so I said, I'll take it. And so
you went to Freetown?
Freetown, straight.
As you with your job was?
I was commanding officer of HMS Tagarin, T-A-G-A-R-I-N, Tagarin. I was Naval Communications Officer of West Africa, Naval Intelligence Officer. I was everything you'd like to mention. About 16 caps. Didn't mean a thing. It just meant that there was a huge establishment there, and we were running it down after the war. It was a very, very busy station in wartime. I mean, halfway around the world, in a wonderful place. And my job was to continue the sort of rundown of the establishment and meanwhile act as a senior officer there. I was on the table of precedence, which was very good indeed, mm-hmm. so that every time the governor gave a party or anything, I was always there. And if he had awkward people for lunch, some sucker on the table of precedence, usually plumber, had to go up and be there just to make up weight. Mm-hmm. So it caught a little bit of trouble because the army was in great strength there. The district commander was Brigadier Joe Parry, and he was a wonderful man. But his colonel of the regiment was only it wasn't a substantive colonel, he was a major, and I was senior to him as a major. Mm. And he could not bear it when he got promoted temporarily to colonel that he wasn't on the table of precedence as I was, and it was endless friction. And yet, I got to know him very well indeed, a bloke called Upjohn, Gordon Upjohn. He finished up as a general. Mm. But it was...
What was the atmosphere like there? Because, I mean, it had been used a lot. I mean, Sierra Leone, West Africa has never been the most stable of places, has it?
It was a very well-run colony. Very well run. The governor was quiet but good. He was Sir Robert de Zouche Hall, his name was. Lady Hall was a bit of a chaos. She had a figure on a face that only a mother could love, but he was a very nice man. Wonderful government house, but getting rid of anything that you own, even if it only belongs to the Navy, is always rather a sad thing. I had a huge signal station there up on Hill Station itself. I mean, it was worldwide, and we turned that over to cable and wireless. We had bunkering facilities up in the dockyard. I think we had 8 or 9 huge fuel tanks, those things like a gasometer, where ships are going on fuel, all for the war. Mm-hmm. And we turned that over to Shell. And bit by bit, the naval establishment was huge accommodation at a place called King Tom, where my office was, right on the water's edge. And that was a boom defense place. So we had where they set up all the booms was like a parade ground, and I used that as a parade ground. And well over half that, with hundreds of accommodation for hundreds of people, I turned over to the colonial police. And so gradually we reduced right down to a little a dockyard without any facilities for bunkering, where I had over 400 Africans kept the dockyard going and 8 Admiralty civilians. And down at my place, at the naval base, not the dockyard. The dockyard was about 4 miles away from us, upriver. My place, I had 6 chief petty officers, RN, about 100 African ratings, no others, and 1 African petty officer, Karoma. And I had 1 officer, an engineer officer, Tom Scott, and 6 chief petty officers. That was the total RN present there and the 6 Admiralty civilians. Great fun. I loved it. But it was very soon dominated everything there by diamonds. The government geologist who was just retiring was a man, he was a bachelor, but I played golf with him quite a lot, and his little partner, a woman who was as old and insignificant as himself, they sort of almost held hands as we went round playing golf, and he was up country one day, and he thought it was the right sort of place for alluvial diamonds. So when he got back to Freetown, he packed a bag and took a servant with him, and he sort of walked up country, went up by car, and when he got to the sort of various rivers there, he walked, and he put his hand down and was able to pick up diamonds just like that, all alluvial. And so he went back and didn't tell anybody, made a little bag up of diamonds, went to the governor on return weeks later, emptied them out on the governor's table, And the government said, what are those? And he said, they're diamonds. And of course, you couldn't tell. You could have them in your possession for the rest of your life. You'd never know they're diamonds. It looked like a stone, old, no, rough stone, dark, muddy or sandy. And that was the beginning of the trouble, and it's been a trouble ever since. They called in, the British government were immediately informed, and they called in De Beers, the only people to take over. And De Beers set up what was known as a Sierra Leone Selection Trust, SLST.
Is this when you went?
Yes. And the SLST was all De Beers men, but they didn't use De Beers because other people would know what it was all about, diamonds. And they went up country and they mapped the whole area and they divided it into little squares. And there'll be a lot of smuggling, so you might as well make it as accessible to the public as possible. You can go up and you could buy yourself one of those squares, and you then got a number. And they bought all the diamonds you panned out up there. You only used a sort of garden sieve and dig up and put them in water.
Did you go up and do that?
No.
Were you never tempted?
No. I'll tell you what did tempt me, and then later, just a minute. The diamonds were then bought on the spot with huts set up with SLST and people there, and the cash paid. So very dangerous to these people. A lot of cash up there turned into a lot of diamonds, wide open for abuse. And the only people who really wanted them, other than De Beers, were the Russians. They didn't want the gemstones. They wanted industrial stones. So they set up an embassy which was buying diamonds in the next country down, which I think is Angola, isn't it, and across a river. So there was then the awful business of people getting the diamonds, handing in some to the SLST, keeping the rest in their pocket.